an electrode in the brain, and you can high pass it and low pass it, and what are the two signals you can get? I stick an electrode in the brain, I'm going to see something like this. Now, what does this signal on the top represent? I'm sorry? That's true. This animal, yeah, it looks like it's awake. Yeah. This is the raw, unfiltered version of the neural signals. And there are low-frequency components and high-frequency components. And if you low-pass this voltage trace that is coming from an electrode going to your amplifier to your data acquisition system, if you low-pass it, what kind of signal are you getting? Getting an average. What particularly is it called, and what kind of brain signal is it? I mentioned that there's a certain type of signal on Monday that it represents some synaptic activity in the brain. That's right. Very good. So if you low pass it, you get the field potentials. And if you high pass it to get the high frequency components of your voltage signal, what do you get? What generates fast transients in the brain? Action potentials. So again, everything we're going to be talking about for the next hour is going to be about what you can do once you high pass and low pass this voltage signal through the brain to get your field potentials and to get your spikes. So what we saw before, these are the raw signals, and if we do the passing of it, you take the same signal, you low pass it to get the oscillations of the some synaptic activity, and you high pass it, and you get this kind of noisy, blurby thing, which is the bane of all neuroscientists, because recording single unit activity is hard. But you see you have a noise floor and then these short little transients. The big transients you saw when we were recording from the cockroach the other day, those are the spikes. So this represents the noise floor, and these little blips are purportedly neural discharge in the form of spikes or action potentials. Okay, so we've now high-passed our electrophysiological signal, and I showed you this image on Monday. And so this is from Pride of Michigan, the Center for Neural Communication Technology in the EECS building, using MEMS technology, printing multi-electrode arrays. So again, we have here 32 different sites on our electrode array, and approximately 50 to 80% of the sites appear to have unit activity. Now, the way chiefly you isolate unit activity is you use a threshold discrimination window. These are all threshold discrimination windows. So if you have any signal, I don't know how much electronics instrumentation you've had in this class or in your other classes, but here we have our O-scope screen, right? Everybody knows what an oscilloscope is? Anyone have one at home? Oh, a couple of you do. Okay, so I have my, we have our generic needle and brain here going to our amp, going to our oscilloscope or our computer. And so you're going to have a time-varying trace. Again, it's high-pass filtered, so you have all these transients. And so how do you isolate it such that you can detect all the various species of neurons? So like I said on Monday, if you stick an electrode in the brain, your electrode tip is surrounded by various neural sources, up to 10,000 different neurons, though in reality you only record a multi-activity hash and 2 to 4 single units riding on top of it. So if I have a trace that looks like this, what does this look like? How many cells do you think I'm recording from in this trace? Three or two. The amplitude can slightly vary due to pulsing of the brain and the neurons coming farther and closer to your neural electrode trip. But we could all in this room confidently say that we're probably recording from two neurons. So, in our oscilloscope, we set up our little threshold or trigger. And so if we look at what is triggered, we see the different species. So every time the voltage trace crosses the threshold, it then plots it on the screen. And these are blown up views, so these are about 2 milliseconds. And typically on an oscilloscope, you're looking at about 10 milliseconds. So the waveform is elongated. So we have this threshold. And so imagine if we have two cells, this big one's going to be here, and this smaller one will be right here. Well, let's, for pedagogical purposes, let's make it a little smaller. And that's indeed what's happening on these neural recordings, that we have a number of different species that are crossing a threshold. The high amplitude spike is this yellow one, and the green and blue are either multi-unit activity or another single unit. Now this is then what you can do is then, based on the characteristics of the wave shape in your software, you can then parse out the different neural populations. So one way is to simply have a box, right? And anytime it goes through here or through here, classify it as a spike. Another way is to decompose the waveform into principal component analysis, which sounds fancy, but you have this waveform that represents maybe 50 data points. Can we reduce it dimensionally into only two or three axes? So if we use something like principal component analysis, well, let's just do two axes here, where, say, the tau of the waveform is one dimension and the amplitude of the waveform is another dimension. So the decay of the waveform of these two waveforms is identical, so they'll be the same on one axis. But then if we look at the amplitude, you're going to end up having about two clusters in this space. And that is precisely what you see here. It's not very, it's rather dim. But you can see that in this projection that's reducing the dimensionality of this waveform, you can see in this 2D projection, here are the yellows, here are the greens. You can get a PhD in neuroscience by figuring out ways to do this automatically. This is called spike sorting. Again, spike sorting is how do you take a high-pass voltage trace and isolate the separate neural components. People are trying to make it automated, especially in the context of neuroprosthetics, which in the last hour of my last lecture on Monday, we'll do the cool science fiction stuff that you can do with these techniques. But at the moment, this is typically done by hand in a laboratory where you have 16 to 32 different sites. You play with the threshold windows. You play with the principal components or wavelets or artificial neural networks, or pick your favorite algorithm to reduce the dimensionality of this and cluster cut and do your proper spike sorting to isolate single units. So you've now isolated your single units that look like single units just on the basis of the amplitudes, but they may not be single units. This trace right here may be from more than one source, and it's easy to imagine why. So again, we take our little favorite trace here where you see, well, we all agreed, it appears we have two neural sources that we're recording from based on the amplitude and then some of the waveform shapes that I just talked about. But does this necessarily have to only be one neural source? No, why not? Could be synchronous. That is a very good point. So you could have two riding on top of each other, which there's no way to determine that given modern science. What else could it be? Where your electorate is. If I have one microphone and two people speaking at identical volume and they have the exact same voice, they're going to look the same on my sensor, even though in actual reality they're two different sources. So how can we there is a way to determine whether or not we're recording from single sources or multiple sources. This is important when you're trying to understand neural coding and the contributions of single units to behavior. What is something that neurons do that allows you to isolate whether or not they're single units? What did Chris talk about when talking about the kinetics of ion transfer flow in membranes? I'm sorry? Calcium has something to do with it? Is there something about the time course of these events? Refractory period. Neurons can only fire mostly at about 200 hertz. So an obvious is if I'm seeing something like this, right, where I'm seeing neurons firing at 1,000 hertz, either I'm recording from some crazy insect muscle, which is doubtful if you're recording from a mammal, or you're recording from multiple sources. So what you can do to determine whether it's an isolated neural source is do something we like to call autocorrelation. An autocorrelation is simply, well, it can mean a lot of things depending on what field of engineering or statistics or physics you're in. But autocorrelation simply means correlating a signal to itself, right? So I have spike, little spike right here. Well, this is a big spike. What I do is I measure the length of time between this spike and all the other spikes. And so I have a spike train. Right here I have like four spikes, but if, you know, you're recording for an hour, you're going to have thousands upon thousands upon thousands of these spikes. And I do this measurement, spike to nearest neighbor, for every single spike. And I then plot this. We're going to do 0, 10 milliseconds, negative 10 milliseconds, spike counts, what do you think this will look like if it's from a single neuron? If it's from a single neuron, what's happening in a sweet spot around 0, which is where a spike occurs? It's going to look like a valley. All right? So you're going to see, if it's from a single neuron, you're going to see 0 spikes approximately 2 milliseconds plus and minus the occurrence of every spike. Now, the reason it doesn't look like a brick wall is because you have absolute refractory periods, which is this 2 millisecond absolute limit that a neuron can fire again, but you also have something called relative refractory periods. Did Chris talk about that? Relative refractory periods just mean you have 2 milliseconds from when a neuron can fire one spike to when it can fire another one. But then there's approximately 2 to 3 milliseconds where the threshold to have another spike is higher. So the number of spikes that occur in the spot from 2 to 5 milliseconds are going to be lower than, you know, the flat line up here. That's why it doesn't look like a flat thing here. And if we're recording from multiple neural sources, and we do this autocorrelation technique, what is this going to look like? It's going to be a flat line up top. Because if you're recording from multiple neural sources, you're going to have so many spikes And each spike doesn't care about when another spike occurred. Though in neural coding it does, but in neural recording, if you're recording from multiple sources, you're not going to see the refractory period. So you do that, online, and you can determine your single units. We love single units in neuroscience. You're recording from one single discrete entity in the brain, trying to determine what it does. When you're recording from multiple sources, when you're recording from, say this is, represents three different spikes, they all may be doing different things, and they may actually be washing out each other, and you won't be able to see any response in your experiments or in your neuroprosthetic. And so here is an experiment I did. These are real neurons. This was when I was recording from a rat doing an experiment. Here's the waveform of the neural signal of the spike. It's approximately 300 microvolts. It's huge. I was really close to the electrode. This neuron was really close to the electrode tip. When it's really close to the electrode tip and it's stable, and the animal's chronically implanted, you can therefore record, if you're lucky, for multiple days. And if you can record for multiple days, then you can start doing interesting experiments on learning about how neurons change their response properties as a function of your experiment. It's really hard because the rat or the monkey or the human can bang their head and subtly shift the electrode and you lose your neural source. This was an experiment that took 2 years and I got 6 neurons that I was able to hold for this amount of time. Never doing it again. So you can see here that when I submitted this for publication, I had to make the claim that I was recording from single units over multiple times. That's hard because we don't have like a camera on top of the probe that can like record the neurons and see what we're recording from. All we have are the spike discharges. And of course, if we're recording from similar neurons in a similar neural space and they're equidistant, then you might have similar looking features on the voltage trace. But given the technology I had at my disposal, I used relative shape of the waveform. So you can see they all look relatively similar. And then I also used shape of the autocorrelogram. This autocorrelogram is also a signature of the neurons. If it's a very bursty neuron, it tends to fire like then you're going to see like peaks that, you know, that it's going to fire. A lot of spikes happen at 10 milliseconds, at 20 milliseconds, at 30 milliseconds. If the firing rate is more heterogeneous, that a spike tends to happen not in any typical bursting way, then you see this kind of gradual sloping function right here. And feel free to interrupt me. I know this stuff is rather detailed. All right, so you've isolated your single units. So this is a human. I didn't bring my speaker today, but they're recording from a unit in the hippocampus while they're playing scenes from a movie. This is a single unit transformed into a rate function. Yeah. I think. Is that okay? So does do you want me to keep this off for the rest of the lecture? But you can see what I'm drawing on the board? Okay. All right, so Now he's recalling what he was seeing. His voice is muffled to protect his identity. This is a patient. On Oprah. So evidently this neuron in hippocampus is a structure that helps in the coding of memory. He has cells in his brain that are devoted to encoding Tom Cruise. And we all do, because we all know who Tom Cruise is. And if you believe in physicalism, that the brain is encoding all we know, that means that we all have parts of our neurons that encode this guy, which I'm not very proud of. So this is the simplest. This is a simple form of coding. If you remember from the cockroach experiment on Monday, that when I blew on the leg, it increased the discharge. It's called rate coding. When this patient in particular saw Tom Cruise jumping on the couch on Oprah, you notice that there was a short delay between when we saw it and then when the spike increased. So, I mean, it's got to go to your eye. It's got to go to parts of your brain to recognize the features in his face, and then recognizes it as Tom Cruise, and then it starts firing. See? It's hard to detect, but there is a lag. And if you noticed on the other one, where he was doing a free recall, the spike rate increased because he's recalling, and then he said, I recalled Tom Cruise. So, kind of interesting. So that's a simple form of coding, rate coding. They've isolated a single unit using the laborious techniques I just explained in detail over the past 20 minutes. So they've isolated a single unit, and they now can show this wonderful thing. And so the reason I said before is why you want to isolate single units is that imagine if we were recording from multiple neural sources, we didn't know it. What would you expect to see if we're in an object recognition part of the hippocampus when we're recording from multiple neural sources? Someone murmured a lot more. That's right. So, you know, you might hit on the Jennifer Aniston neuron or the Darth Vader neuron and say this neuron is encoding Tom Cruise and Jennifer Aniston and Darth Vader. But you're really recording three neurons. Maybe esoteric, but if every neuron element is discrete, you want to understand neural coding, you really want to isolate every single unit and know precisely what it's encoding. This also raises the philosophical issue, is actually Tom Cruise represented in this neuron? Is he actually stored somewhere in the synaptic structure that when all the features get together, the couch and his face and his hair, that neuron is activated? Or is some other part of the brain activated and is projecting to this part of the brain? Very tricky thing to isolate when you're doing experiments, as what are you recording the source of the neural signature, as it were. One of the ways you can do it is through silencing this neuron by cooling and a variety of other techniques. But actually determining if this in fact the ghost of Tom Cruise in this neuron is very tricky. And all right, so like I said before, when we were talking about neural signals, one way to break it down what I said, what's wonderful about spikes is we have our voltage discharge right here. But what is wonderful about spikes that makes the processing a lot computationally more efficient or easy? They're all or none. So we're in our 458 lab, and we turn this into a series of ticks. These are called rasters. And then we can do our nice little MATLAB or LabVIEW or C++ coding, you know, and do all our data analysis. So you can see here that this is an experiment my friend Harak did. A rat was putting its nose in a center hole, and on presentation of a tone, he was trained to move either left or right into a separate nose hole, depending on the frequency of the tone presented. And you're recording from a single neuron using the techniques we just described in the motor cortex, and again, the motor cortex encodes voluntary movement. And so you can see each one of these ticks is a raster representing a single trial of the rat making a movement. These black dots you don't need to worry about. Zero is movement onset. Looking at this neuron, what kind of claims can we make about the property, the response properties of this neuron? It seems to be encoding, because there's more spikes, if we talk about rate coding, it seems to be preferentially selective for movements to the right versus movements to the left. And you can maybe even argue that it's disinhibited or preferentially disinclined for movements to the left. Did I get it backwards? It prefers movements to the right, does not prefer movements to the left. So we're looking at these individual rasters. Neurons do more than one thing often. What do all these other spikes mean? But let's try to get some kind of average activity. And so if we take all these and collapse into Y dimension, we can generate peri-event stimulus histograms. And it looks much more obvious that the single neuron is increasing its discharge rate when the animal is moving to the right versus the animal moving to the left. And it seems like it's even decreasing when the animal's moving to the left. This is a sort of form of rate coding again. Now, of course, you have 100 billion cells in your neocortex. Your brain. You have 100 billion cells in your brain. Not every single one is just doing one thing. Often neurons may be doing multiple things. They may have multiple jobs. And so what we can look at is population coding. Population coding refers to the ensemble of neurons encoding some feature of sensory space or movement. So these were experiments, very influential experiments, done in the early 80s by Georgopoulos and Schwartz at the University of Minnesota. What they did is they trained monkeys to move a manipulandum, basically a big joystick, in 8 directions, up, down, left, right, and various diagonals. This is a highly trained monkey. They did it over a period of 3 weeks, 3 months. And every one of these single dots is a vector representing direction and strength of neural coding. So they're recording from 80 different cells serially now. This is they're recording from a single cell every day. But the monkey's highly trained, so they just collapse all the data across all cells, all directions, on all training sessions. And so, you combine all the activity of the 80 neurons. Each neuron appears to have a preferred vector, that some neurons encode this direction better. And then the same neuron, it's hard to see, but encodes much less the other direction. But if we combine all these vectors from the whole population, we can reconstruct the directional movement of what the monkey made via this population coding. If you do it all at the same time, not recording just one neuron, but 80 neurons at the same time, and you know these population vectors beforehand, what do you think you could do? You can predict what happens. A lot of money, a lot of scientists, a lot of experiments are indeed trying to do that. One way, as I said on Monday, to test whether you understand the neural code in the area of the brain you're recording from is, can you predict what the animal is doing based on the response properties of the neurons you're recording from? And indeed, as we'll see on Monday, you can do some exciting things by recording from the motor cortex if you know the code. Okay, so what we just talked about was what you can do with a single unit, what you can do to spiking activity, how you can transform the data such that you can start making some observations and manipulations to try to understand the neural code. You could also get a dissertation in this, spend a lifetime on the neural code. There are many, many journal articles out there that attempt to crack it, but it's hard, and it should be. So what about the other signal that I was talking about, the low-pass filter signal? Does anybody remember what it's called? Field potential. So this was an experiment my colleague Rio Vetter did here at UM, where he trained rats on a handed task where the rat had to put its forepaw in the small hole in this plexiglass, hit these levers. So let's see what this looks like. This is real speed. He's very well trained. He's running to the opposite side of the cage to eat a food pellet. So you can see he's doing a stereotype motion with his paw. Okay. Again. All right. So, local field potentials, since they come from multiple neural sources, are also noisier, so the analysis techniques are a bit harder because they're not all or none. It's very hard, like when I show my spike train, right? We have these all or none events with very distinct waveforms that we can confidently say and convince most neuroscientists in a room that we're recording from spikes. But when we're recording local field potentials, we have this kind of like low amplitude oscillatory thing that, you know, I show to somebody who's green to this. It just looks like noise. So the methods for analyzing this are not as straightforward, but you can analyze them. And one way you can determine whether or not they actually represent brain activity is see if they're time-locked to behavioral events. So what we see over there are 16 sites. All these traces represent single sites along a single shank multi-electrode array from the experiments I showed on Monday, the same type of electrode. And this is called a PSTH, same as with the spikes, but now we're looking at the field potentials. So we have our signal here, and we have our speedy, well-trained rat. We have our events. And he hit with his forepaw here, and here, and here. Then what we could do is take an average by taking the snippet around here, the snippet around here, and on, and on, and on. The rat typically does that about 200 times in a single session. You then take the average. And lo and behold, time zero is when the rat hit the lever. We see something time-locked to the behavioral event. And it appears that the local field potentials are changing. This is depth in the cortex, whereas site 100 is 100 microns from the surface of the brain. 1600 is the depths of the neocortex, the wrinkly part of the brain. And so we're sampling the whole laminar structure of the neocortex in this behavioral task. And it appears in the lower layers, they look similar. In the upper red layers, they look similar. But in the middle layers, it appears that the amplitude does a phase shift, where it changes from positive deflection to a negative deflection. And if you consider the structure of the neocortex, well, you would begin to consider the structure of the neocortex if you saw data like this. Now, one problem, like I said before, is that since field potentials represent summed synaptic potentials, and they can be recorded farther away from the electrode tip than spikes, we have our neurons. We can only record neurons plus or minus 100 to 150 microns away from the neural tip. But field potentials, we can record millimeters to centimeters away from the tip. So they suffer from so you have volume conduction issues. If you actually recorded these field potentials, they all kind of look the same. So it's very hard to interpret. But if you do these time-locked averages, you can see that there's a phase shift in around the middle layers, which can make you begin to think of the structure of the neocortex. If, again, we have six layers, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6. These are input, processing, and output layers of the neocortex. It appears that something is happening in the middle layers. Maybe the source of the dipole that's generating these field potentials is in that. And one way we can determine that is the current source density analysis, where we simply take the spatial derivative of this and see precisely where the deflections occur. And then you can start making claims about current flow in the cortex. I know this is complicated stuff. All right, so one way we can look at the field potentials is via the time domain with the evoked potentials and current source density analysis, which I just rapidly went through. Any time-varying signal can be analyzed in time and what? Frequency. So these are all signals varying in time. They're also varying in frequency. This is the EEG recorded from the forehead, where you can actually determine roughly the state of the person based on the frequency content of the signal. So what we can do is take a power spectral density, which is just transforming your signal into its frequency components. Here's an example of a rat in slow wave sleep and a rat when he's waking and exploring. And what you can see, I don't know why this author decided to have different scales on the y-axis. Makes it a little bit harder to conceptualize, but that when the rat was awake, there's higher power in the upper frequencies versus the lower frequencies, with a brief blip at 8 hertz, which in the rat literature is called theta, which is involved in spatial navigation. So this is all across an entire behavioral session. We can look at the frequency content of the whole session, but since it's a time-varying signal, the frequency content, like any song you listen to, the frequency components are changing with time. So if we want to look at something in both the time domain and a frequency domain, the Y is power, dB. If we want to look at both the time domain and the frequency domain, anyone who's in speech therapy, who is a sound engineer, knows what I'm talking about. What can you do? You can create a spectrogram. So the ways of looking at field potentials are a bit more subtle, but pretty much the same kind of stuff you would use for audio processing, you can also use for neural processing. Anything you can use for voltage signal analysis. I like to say when I'm giving tours of my lab and I'm showing all this extensive, expensive electronic neuroscience equipment, that it's really just an audio system on steroids. So here you can see that they're taking a window in time on a single channel recorded from a rat in the hippocampus during various behavioral epochs. And so if you take a chunk, say half a second long, decompose it into its frequency elements, and then slide this in time, you can see the evolving changes in the frequency content of the signals throughout behavior. And so you can see in slow wave sleep, there's no scale here, but the darker the color, the higher the power of the neural signal in respect of frequency. So REM, what happens in REM, people? You dream. So, interesting bit of neuroscience, the activity of your brain in REM is pretty much the same, not exactly the same, but if you're looking at this, it looks pretty similar to when the animal is awake and exploring. But when the rat is in slow wave sleep, which dominates most of the sleep you all had last night, about 80%, it's dominated by the low frequencies that I showed just now. So we've looked at ways of looking at the spikes via rate coding and population coding of the discharge rate of the spikes. We've looked at the LFPs in terms of their spectrum across the whole session and in time. But gee, wouldn't it be nice to look at both at the same time? If spikes and LFPs are both generated by nervous system tissue, and electricity and neurotransmitters are the currency of communication in a functioning brain, should we only look at one thing? In the past, people did not really look at the local field potentials. You had your human physiologist that recorded ECOGs and EEGs, and your animal physiologist looked at the spikes. But now there's increasing interest in understanding the interplay between the two signals. And anybody remember, we spent a great deal of time at the last lecture talking about this, what we did, how we transformed this into this. Every time a spike occurred, we then took epochs around the LFP and field potential and generated an average of what happened to the field potentials every time a spike occurred. And as I said before, this is an anesthetized rat dominated by slow oscillations. The spike rate of the neuron is discharging in bursts, and it seems to be firing at the negative deflections of the neuron. Negative deflections of the field potential. And again, in awake behaving animals, things are a lot more complicated in the brain. We do the same thing. The spikes are modulating a lot more heterogeneous, low amplitude LFP and ECOG, and the spike rate average is not as clean, though there does seem to be some phase locking to various events in the STA. Now, how can we determine the frequency of phase locking in the spike-triggered average? We take the power spectral density again. So now we're really diving into data analysis, and this will be the last one in the toolbox, though we could spend a whole course. If you guys are interested, look up Woods Hole Marine Biological Laboratory. You can spend 8 weeks to 4 weeks just doing this every day. So, you take spike-triggered average, where you're taking the occurrence of a spike and time-locking it and aligning it to your field potential ECOG. We then randomize the spikes, the spike occurrences, and then take the spike-triggered average to the LFP and ECOG. And not surprisingly, when we randomize the spikes, all frequency phase locking is gone. I'd hoped it would be. Otherwise, that means that this is just noise. But since it's not, we take this power spectral density of these two signals. So you can see the power spectral density of a randomized spike triggered average is lower, does not appear to have many frequency components. If we do it to the real signal, we appear to have ripples occurring under 50 hertz. We take the ratio between these signals. We're now looking at the power of the phase locking, the spikes, to the field potential. What does it mean? Good question. But we get data that looks like this, where we are looking at the frequency of phase locking, of the spikes to the field potential. And not surprisingly, as you could see in the original data, in the anesthetized state, you have frequency of phase locking in the low frequencies, but in motor learning and neuroplasticity mode, which we won't talk about, the phase locking has now shifted to higher frequencies. And this kind of makes sense. The discharge rate of neurons is usually faster in awake behavior. It's more heterogeneous. And also, if things are simply phase locking at 1 to 2 hertz, that represents a low information state. But if they're much entrained at much higher frequencies, you can cram much more information into higher frequencies than low frequencies. And the relationship between spikes and field potentials continues to be a major effort of neuroscience to this day. Okay, so I've talked a bit about data analysis. We'll cover this all again, this toolbox. I know it's a lot of stuff. But there also is a problem when you're doing neural signal analysis or any type of analysis when you're trying to extract information from a small subset. A neuroscientist can be proud if he publishes a paper where he is recording from 200 to 300 cells during a behavioral task. That population encoding I showed with the monkey was about 80 cells. But again, the brain has 10,000 neurons per cubic millimeter of neural tissue and 100 billion neurons in general. And so if we record a couple neurons and try to correlate it to some behavioral task, you run the danger of overfitting your data. So as a joke, my colleague and I, Greg Gage, who's also working on me with the cockroach stuff, published a paper in 2006 where we made the bold claim that stock market behavior is predicted by rat neurons. And so you can see, if you watch CNN, if you buy and sell a few stocks, we have this ticker of all the stock prices. And we have a rat where we're recording his brain signals as he's doing a behavioral task. Now, like I've said, everything I've done here, we're going to talk about stimulation a little bit in the next hour, but everything I've done here is simply correlating some feature of your neural signal to some externality via in the world, via visual processing or motor movement. But correlation is not causation. You know, the height of the NBA players, my favorite player is Rasheed Wallace, and the price of beer have both gone up in the last 20 years. That does not mean that beer has made basketball players taller. Probably make them shorter. And conversely, there are more neuroscientists alive today than there ever have been in all time. But with advances in materials and increases in fuel economy, the weight of cars, my favorite car is an El Camino, the weight in cars has decreased, though the number of neuroscientists has increased. And again, we cannot make the claim that the weight of a machine has led to an increase in neuroscientists. But perhaps we can play games with correlation, right? You can just let your mind run free that the experiments I do affect my purchasing power and my happiness. If my experiments go well, I may spend money on a Pistons game. If I spend my money at a Pistons game, it may affect the stocks of all the products I buy, which can affect world consumption and the environment, which can affect agriculture, which can affect the food that a rat eats, which can affect his buying rates, which can affect the results of my experiments, and so on and so forth. Hey, it's a hypothesis. That's what scientists do. We call this the Gaia hypothesis. James Lovelock in the 70s came up with this. So, my friend Greg, he worked in the corporate world for about 5 years before going to grad school. And so he had access to software to pull every single stock off the U.S. stock market over a period of 7 days. And we recorded the average firing rate of the neurons from four rats over the same 7 days. And it's amazing. You can see the firing rate of this neuron in this rat brain in blue, and the stock price of Coca-Cola Bottling Company. Doesn't look like a coincidence to me. And if we further cherry pick, you know, and cherry pick and find the stock that matches the firing rate of the neurons, we can play games with shorting stocks and make the claim that we can actually make money by looking at the spike rates of our rats. So this is pedagogical, is meant to tell a lesson that simply if you have a number of signals and a wide variety of other signals, you're always going to find correlations. You always have to be very careful. And generally, you can call this how I learned to love the Bonferroni correction, and usually you divide your number of comparisons by the number of samples you have. But that's boring. So instead, we decided to show it via the stock market rat neural signal thing. So that's it for the lecture on neural analysis. We'll take a 5 to 10 minute break, and then we'll move on to how you can actually manipulate the brain.